from mandibular involvement, which may be God's way of dealing with women, but often it's a diathyroidal joint, it's a synovial line joint, and as bizarre as it sounds, it could be the face, it could be the back. All right, the patient presents, I went to bed feeling fine, he gets up in the morning and he's crippled. He has an acute episode of pain. He often interpret this as unrecognized trauma. And if it's the first or second attack, the diagnosis becomes easy. Patient has had a past history of previous events, and often he can barely walk. And if you're seeing the patient now a year or two into his illness, he's had several joints that are involved at the same time. If it's a lower extremity, it could be his great toe, podagra, it could be his ankle, it could be his elbow, it could be a DIP joint in the hands, or it can be the knee. Right, and the no-brainer in terms of the diagnosis when it works out is a very high uric acid, which is helpful sometimes. Often the first attacks of the gout have little to do with an absolute uric acid level. So if you're looking to make a diagnosis of gout and you rely solely on the uric acid, and they come in having a uric acid of 5 or 4, and you leisurely walk away, this is obviously an infection, you're going to miss the diagnosis. If it's somebody with established gout, and or he comes in with uric acid of 11.5, which is a caricature, life can be made a little easy. In terms of managing the patient, when you have the leisure, you can do a 24-hour collection of urine for uric acid. And that becomes helpful in terms of therapeutic decisions that you have to make after everything cools down. And again, if this is somebody with established gout, he has bony erosions, overhanging edge, the medial side of the first MTP joint is usually destroyed. Okay, so what does he have? He obviously has the gout, which is easy, and what can we do about it? This is what the patient looks like. He has an acute synovitis, he has his ankle and his first MTB joints. And if you have the luxury of seeing somebody like that, and he comes into your office, and you're not at Jacoby Hospital, and you're sitting in Great Neck, where my office is, you feel fairly comfortable with the diagnosis. When you're sitting at Jacoby Hospital, you really are not that comfortable with the diagnosis, because patients often have multiple things going on, and ongoing infection in a joint can certainly trigger the gout. So you really have to be very, 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 very careful. Somebody walking into my office like that, and one of my nursing the patient would ask me whether I want to aspirate the joint or inject the joint, and everybody knows what the patient has. Often part of the gout is a chronic olecranon bursitis, and the erythema is sort of, again, is a giveaway. Olecranon bursitis is traumatic, except in patients with the gout. Olecranon bursitis, if it's not the gout, in my office is rheumatoid arthritis. Classic in terms of the onset is sort of a no-brainer. Patient is fine, he gets the acute episode of pain, he comes into your office, and he has physical findings like we just projected. The diagnosis becomes, is fairly easy. So it's sudden onset early in the history of the disease. If the disease is ongoing, patients also often have a smoldering subacute chronic arthropathy. And you have to be very, very careful, because patients with advanced gouty arthritis can often look for all the world like rheumatoid arthritis patients. So you really have to be very, very careful. And if you have a female, it becomes even harder, because whatever the mechanism, females have a predilection to get gout in pre-existing osteoarthritic fingers, especially in their DIP joints. So if you see somebody that presents to you classic osteoarthritis and they have a synovitis joint, you have to worry. And you worry that it could be the gout, you worry that it could be infection, or you worry about that other illness that presents with distal interphalangeal synovitis. What's that illness? Somebody comes into your office and they have DIP joints that are inflamed, they're red, they're swollen.
Psoriatic
arthritis, yeah. Or seronegative reactive arthritis. Okay, so DIP joints in females sometimes create a lot of difficulty. And you sometimes have to needle the patient to make sure you're not dealing with an infection, and needle the joint to confirm that you're dealing with true disease. Again, as long as the population that you're dealing with is a standard population, it's a disease of males. It does become a disease of females once the female goes through her menopause and she exceeds the age of 55. Usually it's excruciating pain, and it's distal joints. And distal joints are the MTP joints, the feet, but it can be distal joints here. You really have to be very, very careful. And it's intense inflammation and looks for all the world like infection. So by the time I get to see the patient, if I see do a consult in the hospital, the patient has already been on antibiotics, has not responded to antibiotics, and what's going on. Recurrent episodes, diet. How does diet influence gout? Diet influence gout. How?
Increasing the amount of proteins. Increasing the proteins.
Well, if you okay, so if you get an excess amount of purines into your purine-containing foods into your diet, it works. The only problem is this is 2010, and purine-containing foods are expensive. And purine-containing foods are difficult to come by, and purine-obtaining, foods are not part of the Western diet any longer. How many people have had liver in the past year? You did, all right. So that's one out of how many? All right, Or other organ foods. I mean, I love sweetbreads. Love sweetbreads. And I've had it. I had it this year in the middle of. I can remember the meal. But I mean, how many people who eats sweetbreads anymore? Kidney, lung, brain. I mean, this is not part of what the normal diet is. So if you have to make a recommendation in terms of really have to take it easy with the high purine-containing foods, it becomes a very difficult exercise, at least in the West. But the bottom line is excess anything. If you just decide to gouge and you have an excess of food without alcohol, that's going to trigger. And if you decide to become very religious and you want to go on a diet, you go on an overzealous diet, that also can trigger it. So starvation can trigger it, and gluttony can trigger it. That becomes very, very interesting when you have to figure out what to do with the patient, once you've established the diagnosis. Anyway, diet does influence it, and taking in too much and too little. Purine-containing foods are becoming a non-entity in this country. Alcohol is a given, so if you take an excess amount of alcohol, you're going to trigger the gout. And, all right, what happens to patients and why? God knows why, okay? This is that patient's ankle and foot. And if you're good and you can get into an ankle that's swollen and aspirated, you get these things. And these are absolutely gorgeous to look at. What are those? That's birefringence using a red compensator, and you get these gorgeous yellow needles, and you see them, they're actually very pretty to look at. If you don't have a compensator, you should be able to make a diagnosis of gout crystals just by looking at the polarized image. They're actually beautiful, they fluoresce intensely, and it's really something you really can't miss. So if you go with morphology, forget the red light compensator, forget negative birefringence, you should be able to distinguish between a uric acid crystal and a calcium pyrophosphate crystal. A calcium pyrophosphate crystal is a blunt structure, and it doesn't shine up at you the way this is. Now, if you saw this, would you make a diagnosis of gout if you went into somebody's joint? if you saw this picture, this is like the gold standard. That works in most offices except Jacoby Hospital. If you don't see cells, I mean, this was a topaz that was aspirated. But if you go into somebody's joint and you see these beautiful crystals, and you don't see them intracellularly, then you have to worry about concurrent conditions. And a joint infection in the setting of gout will give you crystals, and it'll give you white cells. And unless you see intracellular uric acid crystals, you really are not on this most solid ground. So you really have to be continuously vigilant. Okay, gout-induced inflammation, this sort of works up until the past ACR meetings. You have a high uric acid level. The uric acid in the joint is moving around, it starts to crystallize. You get protein binding, receptor binding, you get cytokine release, you get an influx of polymorphic nucleosides. They ingest crystals and you get a crystal explosion. If it was as simple as that, life would be very, very easy. We're trying to figure out why somebody who is hyperuricemic, very hyperuricemic, it was induced by diuretic therapy, or it was induced by chemotherapy, and his uric acid level, he's being blasted by his oncologist, and his uric acid level goes up to 13 or 14. Why doesn't this patient get gout? And we don't really understand it. So part of it may be the genetic program. Somebody is now relating it to presence or absence of free fatty acids, and this an interesting article that was just published trying to sort out what's going on. Why, if you have two patients, one with a uric acid of 11 or a uric acid of 10, the other one with a uric acid of sky high, how come the sky high one doesn't get sick? They do get sick, but they don't get acute attacks of the gout. I mean, they get all the other complications, the really bad complications like, you know, renal stones or possibly nephropathy, but they don't get attacks of the gout. And I don't think anybody really understands. And anyway, the polymorphic nucleosides are important. You have to, when you're making the diagnosis, you have to find uric crystals engulfed. Okay, so sudden onset, middle-aged male, except when it's a female, severe pain, distal joints, intense inflammation, recurrent episodes influenced by diet, bony erosions. Okay. All right. Hyperuricemia, two mechanisms. One, he is genetically programmed to produce an awful lot of uric acid, and his uric acid production exceeds his body's ability to excrete, so he winds up hyperuricemic. And the reverse. Okay? He doesn't make terribly much, but he has difficulty getting the stuff out of his body. He has difficulty peeing it out. Which do you think is more common?
The second.
Yeah, the second, this. Which is interesting, especially when I conclude. So anyway, this is the real deal in terms of what's happening. The patients usually are not hyperproducing, they're just under-secreting. And this is a no-brainer when you see it. This is classic tophaceous gout. Now, if you didn't see these white excrescence, and you just saw this X-ray, this picture, I'm not so sure you would be able to look at this. If you didn't, this is uric acid. This is uric acid. This is a large tophus. Now, if you look at that, those X-ray, that hand, I'm not so sure you would be able to make that call that easily. Why isn't that rheumatoid arthritis? This is classic location for rheumatoid arthritis. This is PIP arthritis, markedly swollen joints. This patient has a dorsal synovitis. I'm not sure that's not a rheumatoid nodule. The appearance of this wrist is sort of classic. And this patient may actually have ruptured her extensor tendons because of the gout. But it becomes a very, very hard diagnosis, and I can tell you that I have managed or seen patients that were classified as having rheumatoid arthritis. And managed with gold. Gold is a treat drug I'm used to use in the past. Methotrexate, and was receiving biologic therapy and not getting better. Okay, and rheumatoid nodules, not tophi, and classic appearance. Smoldering subacute chronic gouty arthritis looks just like rheumatoid arthritis. Okay, these are the clues. These are the clues, especially when you see this stuff coming out over here, or this thing over here. This is easy to diagnose. If you see this in a patient, you can, if you're a purist and you want to make sure you're not dealing with sebaceous cysts, with pus coming out, chance to illuminate the ear, and if you get dense shadows and you're dealing with tophi. All right. Anybody want to comment on this x-ray? This is called classic. Why would you make a diagnosis of gout, which this is, on this x-ray?
Because the notions and the distant compromise of the organs.
Which? What, this?
Yes.
This?
The other one, yes.
This?
Mm-hmm.
This? And this?
Okay. I said it could be done also by psoriasis.
It could. Okay. Now, the clue that, in other words, why isn't this psoriatic arthritis and penciling in somebody with a seronegative reactive arthritis? Usually, you don't get cortical destruction. Okay. This is a rat bite lesion. This was a uric acid deposit that exploded. The cortex just blew away. And that's usually not the typical finding in a psoriatic. But there have been mistakes, and patients have been labeled psoriatic arthritis, on, you know, but this represents a giveaway. This is a large, this is a tophus, this is a radiodense deposit over here. This is cortical disruption, cortical disruption. You know, and I mean, these are the two giveaways, but the giveaway's all over on this x-ray. I mean, it's unusual in psoriasis to follow the cortex up and get a destructive lesion. These are affectionately called rat bite lesions. And you see a rat bite, you're not dealing with an infection. It's invariably the gout. Again, classic lesion. But arthritis is interesting, and it's, you know, it's, patients often are misdiagnosed. That's what makes mistreated or misdiagnosed. That's what makes the fun of gout. Okay, so it's an arthritis, usually an acute arthritis, but it can be chronic. Tophi, kidney stones, and nephropathy. And most of what's happening in medicine now is nephropathy. Usually, if you have a good urologist, you don't die from kidney stones. Tophi are aesthetically horrendous. If they open up, they can become infected. But again, that does not, should not shorten your life. The arthritis is miserable when you get acute attacks. Again, that should not shorten your life. Nephropathy does shorten your life, and patients develop glomerulosclerosis or interstitial nephritis, and that's bad because that leads to end-stage renal disease. So a lot of the dogma now is addressed at dealing with this entity. Again, there was a paper that was presented at the American College of Rheumatology meeting looking at uric acid levels as an absolute value, and doing some statistical analysis to find out whether it was predictive in terms of mortality and coronary artery disease. And the article was reviewed by somebody who trains here and comes here to talk, Mike Pellinger. And he would, when you're outside of this hospital and you order a chem panel or basic metabolic, uric acid is removed. It was removed by the government. They did not want that assay as part of a routine panel that they, that Medicare is going to pay for. And it turns out that uric acid had almost the same predictive value statistically as an elevated LDL. And this was something that was presented. So it's interesting. I mean, it's unclear whether it's tumor related or whether there's some causality. I think the causality might be similar to the kind of causality that I'm not sure I understand in terms of C-reactive protein. C-reactive protein is something that I follow on all of my patients because it's a quantitative way of doing a sedimentation rate. So I follow my rheumatoids or I follow lupus patients with sedimentation rates and C-reactive proteins, and C-reactive gives me an absolute value. But as everybody knows, C-reactive protein is a predictive risk factor in terms of coronary artery disease. And there was a paper that was presented justifying the use of statins in the setting of patients with normal lipid levels and elevated highly sensitive C-reactive proteins. And that was in New England Journal last year or 2 years ago. So, very interesting. Okay, acute chronic. The common denominator with all of this is hyperuricemia. Okay. This is, you have a gouty male and he's untreated. This is sort of predictive. As long as he has the genetic program, his uric acid is going to go like this in life, unless you do something to intervene. This is where he should be. And the average uric acid in a normal male should be under 6.3 or 6.4. The new standard of normality is not what the lab report says in terms of uric acid level. Your uric acid level in health should be under 6.3. If you exceed 6.3, you're exceeding the solubility of uric acid in body fluid. And theoretically, that is going to start to precipitate out. The gold standard in the past 10, 15, 20, or 30 years was to try and lower somebody who was hyperuricemic to a uric acid level of under 8 or under 7. The current gold standard is to shoot to get the patient to under 6.3. Okay? And this is a female. This is the female pattern of a female with the gout. Usually she remains reasonably normal uricemic. She goes through her menopause and then she takes off. And her computer is set a lot lower than males for whatever reason. And this is a normal male, normal female. This is a gouty female and a gouty male. And we would like, in the setting of disease, to get the patient over to here. And if you don't achieve that, then you're really not managing the patient correctly. Anyway, dietary intake, either excess or lack of diet, alcohol, purine basis, cell breakdown, this is your oncologist. This is a patient with psoriasis with high cell turnover. And purine basis are metabolized to hypoxanthine, xanthine, and there's uric acid. Okay, the common denominator in terms of going from here to here down to over here is xanthine oxidase. And xanthine oxidase represents the major target of the agents that are most commonly used, either allopurinol, which we'll talk about, and febuxostat. Has anybody ever heard of febuxostat? Anybody? All right, that's interesting. Okay. What about Uloric? U-L-O-R-I-C? Okay. There has been no change in available pharmacologic agents to manage the gout up until 2 years ago. And 2 years ago, the first of a new class of medications was released, and that was febuxostat or Uloric. And 3 weeks ago, Pegalate was released. It's an intravenous medication. They're pretty important. Okay, renal handling of uric acid. This is, I don't think there's anybody that is not familiar with this. If you have decreased glomerular filtration, decreased blood flow to the kidney, you're going to elevate uric acid. Patients with gout have increased tubular reabsorption, decreased tubular secretion, and then they have increased post-secretory reabsorption. And the bottom line is an elevated uric acid. Okay. Excess production, inadequate excretion. Overproducers, under excretors. And it probably is important to do this, but if you speak to people out in the field, in the battlefield, and you ask them how many times they've done 24-hour collections of urine to determine whether the patient's management should be to make them pee out uric acid or stop them from producing uric acid, I would say that it's probably done in maybe 5% of the patients with established gout. And we classify you as a hypersecretor or an undersecretor. If you make too much, usually you have a high level of uric acid in your urine. If you're an undersecretor, you have a low, very little. Bottom line is, it shouldn't influence your decisions excessively. Okay, uric acid excess, total body fluid levels of uric acid, deposition of monosodium urate crystals in joints and other tissues, and then you have crystal-induced inflammation. Okay. All right. So treating acute gout, which is what I love to deal with because most of the time it's iatrogenic, it's either using colchicine, NSAIDs, steroids, and allowing the patient to rest. All right. So what have you guys been doing with patients that you've seen in the emergency room or on the floor? How have you managed the patients? Nobody's managed them. Colchicine. Okay.
Colchicine and
NSAIDs. All right, so first attack, second attack, third attack of gout, you're using colchicine? Okay, how do you use it?
I don't remember what is the 0.6 Q4 hours, Q6 hours, depending how well controlled the pain of the patient is. Because I think it can be given even very frequently, Q2 hours.
Okay, alright. So if so if you go with the textbook, it's every 1 to 2 hours until diarrhea. If you let that patient get to diarrhea, they will never come back to you as a doctor. Ever. There's not, the sickness that you get with colchicine given that way is mind boggling. I mean, you the gout is no problem because you never get out of the bathroom, and usually you're in the bathroom for weeks. It's the oral colchicine to treat the gout, one as a diagnostic, well, I want to give it to him as a diagnostic test, I'm not really sure what's going on, so I'm going to give him something, quote, specific for the gout, so I'm going to give him colchicine, I'm going to go with the protocol, which is exactly what you said. Usually, if you have a heart, and the patient doesn't respond by the time you give them the fourth or fifth dose, stop, because they're probably not going to respond because you started the colchicine too late. And they're just going to get sick. So anyway, most patients won't come back to you as a doctor because of their reaction to the colchicine. And most patients, if you tell them, listen, you get an attack, you start the colchicine quickly, you're going to feel better, they won't do it. Anyway, there was a paper that was published saying, listen, this traditional biblical way of treating the gout, maybe there are other ways of doing it. And so there was an article that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, again, it's about a year and a half ago. I think it's about a year and a half ago, where they give patients colchicine 3 tablets a day, and they do it for several days. And usually the patients, after the day and a half, usually respond. So if you're a purist and you want to give this colchicine and you want to give it, then you probably can get away with giving it every 6 hours, but no more than 3 times a day, and doing that for 2 or 3 days. With the proviso that the patient has normal kidney function. If the patient does not have normal kidney function, you're going to get into trouble giving colchicine that way. All right, so anyway, most of my patients won't take colchicine that way because you just get very, very sick. And using non-steroidal anti-inflammatories is a snap. And the traditional drug in the 1970s and 1980s was indomethacin. Originally it was butazolidine. You know, thank God you can't get butazolidine except if you're a vet. And indomethacin is, you know, a neat way of stopping the attack. Usually patients get better quickly, within 24 hours. And the only problem with the indocin is that if you stop the drug quickly, they're going to rebound. So it would be giving them their 150 milligrams day one. As long as they get better, you drop it down to 100 day two, then down to 50 and 25, and you finish with it. If you're really nice to the patient, you can give them steroids. You can give them a Medrol dose pack, methylprednisolone, and usually the very quick taper from 24 methylprednisolone on a 4 milligram tablets is a very, there's a no-brainer card that you give the patient, and patients love it because they just see day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Day 6, they run out of the medication, so you don't have to worry about them restarting the drug again as long as you don't give them as a renewal. So anyway, medical dose pack, or you can stab them, give them an IM injection of methylprednisolone as depomedrol, or if you really have confidence in your diagnosis, you give them an intra-articular injection, and then they really love you because usually in about 6 or 7 hours, they feel great. Okay, so there's a whole lot of ways to treat the acute attack. Colchicine, of all the drugs, has really fallen by the wayside. And these are the acute arthritic drugs. And urate-lowering drugs. And we have three drugs that are listed here with pegylated uricase having just been released 2 weeks ago. And this is the oldest drug. Probenecid or Benamid is vintage 1960 or 62, 63. Has anybody ever used Benamid or Probenecid on your patients? You have? In what situation?
Not here. It's elsewhere and always available.
Okay. Anyway, most of the Probenecid used around Jacoby Hospital is used in patients you discharged from the hospital with gonorrhea, and you really want to maintain a very, very good level of amoxicillin if you decide to send them home. Then giving probenecid in combination with amoxicillin gives you sky-high levels of the drug, and it's a neat way of treating gonorrhea. So it's the drug is used more for drug interactions. Anyway, this is a uricosuric agent. Okay. There's old Ben. Okay, and he had gout, and there was this great drug that was available in France. It was derivative of these leaves, and it was fantastic. You make a tea from the leaves, as long as you have access to reasonably fresh leaves, and you drink the tea, and you wind up defecating your brains out, and the gout goes away. And he basically viewed the cathartic effects of the colchicine leaves as a way of removing the poison from your body via your bowels, which is okay, because we do a lot of bizarre things, and we try to understand them. Nobody is using leeches any longer here. Leeches. Bonkus. Does anybody know what bonkus are? No one has ever heard of bonkus. There's a way of dealing with arthritis by cupping. What you do is you put cups on the patient's body. You know what bonkus? I knew you knew what it was. Okay. Okay. What country are you from?
Colombia.
Okay. All right.
It's still
used here. So anyway, you heat up these cups, you get these gigantic welts. All your body's poisons are pulled to the surface. Once your body's poisons are pulled to the surface, your disease is made better. Okay, so you can cup somebody for pulmonary edema. And you actually, you are phlebotomizing the patient temporarily. They're shifting significant amounts of fluid. I usually don't recommend cupping for my patients, but okay. Anyway, colchicine is the standard of care. It's not only effective in gouty arthritis. What other conditions is colchicine used for? Colchicine. You can use it in a pseudo gout. Okay. Exactly why it works in pseudo gout, I'm not sure, but it may be the same mechanism as it working in real gout. It works in the sarcoid, and there's a condition that it's absolutely a cure for, and prevents you from developing amyloid. And one of the guest speakers that comes to give Graham rounds every couple of years was one of the first people to observe its effects. Familial Mediterranean fever. Okay, so if you have FMF and you're getting repeated attacks of sericitis, you're on colchicine, the sericitis goes away. But one of the terrible complications, as long as you stay alive long enough with FMF is you develop amyloid, and this prevents you from developing, the culture stain prevents amyloid. There's a man named Cohen from Boston University who has used it in patients with primary amyloid doses, not terribly successful. Anyway, it's the important things about culture stain is it's not an analgesic. So it has to have very, very specific properties to shut off FMF, to shut off real gout, to shut off pseudo-gout, to control sarcoid, arthritis, etc. It does not affect renal excretion of uric acid, it doesn't alter plasma solubility of uric acid, and it doesn't do anything to uric acid, but it stops the gout. Nobody really understands how it works. It probably has something to do with interfering with the phagocytosis of uric crystals and release of cytokines. I don't think anybody really understands. If you're going to treat acute attack, then your treatment of one tablet every 2 hours until the patient gets diarrhea, which you don't allow them to do, or until they get better. As soon as the patient says they feel a little better, if you're going to do that, stop the medication immediately. Its use really is this. You want to prevent recurrent attacks of the gout. Okay, side effects are everything. The nausea, vomiting, cramping, diarrhea, and abdominal pain. You go above 6 tablets, you have every one of those, and it doesn't go away. Hematologic, which is easy, agranulocytosis, aplastic anemia, thrombocytopenia. And when you want to study mitosis, you take an onion skin with giant nuclei and you add colchicine and you can arrest mitosis and study everything that you want to know. And muscle weakness. Now, this is a major big deal, and this is a major big deal. And when you see this in patients that you give colchicine to and they have renal insufficiency, if they... 80% of colchicine is cleared by the kidney and 20% metabolized by the liver. So if you give somebody a standard dose of colchicine prophylaxis, which is 1 or 2 tablets daily, and they have a clearance under 20, the colchicine stays in the body, and you can get this muscle weakness business, or you can get a hematologic crisis. The muscle weakness business is called rhabdomyolysis, and when you get rhabdomyolysis, you got a big problem, because now you have another cause for renal failure. Okay, so rhabdomyolysis is a big deal, especially in patients with renal insufficiency to begin with. And that is a real occurrence, and it happens in this hospital on occasion. What is the role in treating acute gout? You would treat the patient with it. It prevents recurrent attacks. It's more useful for daily prophylaxis. And this is the state of the art right now. It's declining. Nobody's really using it for acute gout. Alright, excessive production, inadequate excretion. So the only places that we can attack the illness is over here or over here. Alright, urate-lowering therapy is a no-brainer. You want to prevent repeated attacks of the gout. You want to get the tophi shrunk, and you want to prevent kidney stones. It is not indicated after a first attack. Get somebody who has the gout, and they have one episode of the gout in their lifetime, you have two decisions. One, whether you want to prophylax them. If it's the first attack, probably you would not, because they may not get another attack in their entire life. If they have repeated attacks, that's another story. And this is the deal with allopurinol. This is what makes my office interesting. Usually I get a patient coming in, they have the gout, the doctor, their primary care doctor decided to treat the gout and he started him on allopurinol. And the gout didn't get better and he kept increasing the allopurinol. So usually I get somebody who comes in with polyarticular gout on 300 milligrams of allopurinol with every day getting worse and worse and worse with a new joint appearing. Okay, so never give it in the setting of an acute attack. And initiation of therapy, when you first start a uric acid lowering drug, whether you're going to want to make you pee out the uric acid or stop you from manufacturing it, just lowering uric acid can trigger an attack. And this is no role in managing acute attack. No role. Don't do it here. It's done here. We get to see patients that have this done. All right, so anyway, you gouge, you get in your, you have the correct genetic program, you have hypoxanthine converted to xanthine converted to uric acid. Our standard of care and the most commonly prescribed medication in the setting of acute, of chronic gout is allopurinol or xylopurinol. And this is what the pill looks like. And it's a category C in pregnancy, and it comes in two different strengths. Okay, and basically it works over here and over here, and it works amazingly effectively. You just have to be very, very careful. Has anybody used allopurinol here? Okay. Did you look at the package insert? Are you using allopurinol in the setting of somebody who is that's hyperuricemic, and you're doing it not only to stop his attacks of the gout, but to dissolve those bumps that he has on his body, prevent kidney stones, but really the real reason for using it is to prevent a nephropathy, and that's the real reason. So you then look at the package insert, and I want to give the medication to this patient that has mild renal insufficiency because I don't want it to get major renal insufficiency. And then there's a warning. It says the drug has to should not be used or has to be used with extreme caution in patients with azotemia. And you have somebody with a creatinine of 2 and the uric acid stays at 9 or 10. Do you keep increasing allopurinol? So, if this was 4 or 5 years ago and this was a peer group of rheumatologists, most of the rheumatologists would say, listen, I don't care what the package insert says, we're going to keep increasing the allopurinol until we get the uric acid down to a level of under 6 or 6.3. And you then would have to worry about lawyers, or personal injury lawyers, because if the patient did develop either worsening kidney disease or liver toxicity or something else, they would say, listen, you committed malpractice. The PDR says clearly this. So there was a major, you know, discrepancy between what is correct practice or common practice and what you should be doing in real life. There's also a warning when you use the allopurinol. It says don't go above 300 milligrams. Very, very often at 300 milligrams, the uric acid doesn't budge. It stays at 7 or 8, and if you're going with the standard of care in terms of you really want to get the patient under 6 or 6.3, going to a higher level, which would be acceptable and probably could be defended by, you know, one of your peers in court, is not what the PDR says. So there's a real issue with allopurinol. If the patient has renal insufficiency, which is the classic patient that you really want to protect them from the effects in the setting of gout, of uric acid, and the difficult to control patient who you really want to again protect. Anyway, allopurinol is metabolized to oxypurinol. Now the big deal with allopurinol is that if you block xanthine oxidase, you wind up with hypoxanthine and xanthine increasing in your bloodstream. And as luck would have it, patients do get xanthine stones and hypoxanthine stones. So one of the complications of making the patients better in terms of correcting their uric acid is putting them at risk in terms of other kinds of stones. You really have to encourage them to take in lots of fluids, and there's no way to avoid this theoretical complication. Allopurinol is metabolized to oxypurinol once daily dosing, which is good. It lowers uric acid. It lowers urine uric acid levels, which is good because it does prevent kidney stones. And the side effects are rare, but potentially lethal. The allopurinol is used, obviously, in gout. It's used by oncologists. When you start melting tumor tissue and you're really doing a good job, the patients wind up with outrageously elevated uric acid levels. And even if you're not worried about attacks of the gout because they don't have the correct genetic program to get acute joint pain, you're worried about all of the other consequences, especially stones and nephropathy. And this is a black box warning. It's not recommended for the treatment of asymptomatic hyperuricemia. So you don't have a gout patient. He has uric acids running higher than I said it should be, 6 points. It's above 6.3, it's at 8. The patient has no history of the gout, has not had kidney stones. What do you do with the patient? You leave the patient alone. Okay, side effects of allopurinol. nausea, diarrhea, that's easy. The hard ones are abnormal liver function testing, which means that you really have to periodically get liver screens on the patient. And the other big deal is that as it makes you better with a lower uric acid, the flux downward can trigger attacks of the gout. And the better the drug is in lowering your uric acid, the more rapid it does it, the greater the frequency of acute attacks. Fever, rash, toxic, epidermal necrolysis, liver, bone marrow suppression, vasculitis. Most of these occur... What is that?
My step four.
Okay. Okay. Okay, one of the serious side effects of allopurinol is death. So if any of your patients are on allopurinol, they die. Okay, anyway, the drug interactions are actually good and bad. If the patient is on Imuran, a lot of my patients are on Imuran, they become hyperuricemic. Be careful, do not put them on this drug because their azathioprine levels will go sky high, or their 6-mercaptopurine levels are going to go sky high. This side effect is actually good in certain situations, and that's used around here, around other places, if you want to maintain a very high level of ampicillin or amoxicillin. This you don't want to see. Okay, it's Stevens-Johnson syndrome. And that is a real potential side effect of this drug. The other side effects are urticaria, and you can get a psoriatic-like skin rash or a psoriform skin rash that occurs with this. You have to recognize it. If somebody calls you and says, listen, I've been taking the medication now for 2 months like you told me, and I itch all over, they stop the medication immediately, and you get to see them immediately, and then you got to decide what you want to do with the patient. Now, most of these side effects, although they're very rare, occur in patients with renal insufficiency, and these are the patients that you really want to protect. Okay, now, for Buxostat or allopurinol, that's something that I'm surprised that no one detailed you about. It was a drug that was supposed to be on the scene about 4 years ago. Uric acid as a marker does have some statistical significance, quite similar to LDL in terms of predicting coronary artery disease. When the drug went through its phase 3 study, they had a disproportionate number of patients that were on the drug that wound up with cardiac events. And this was adjudicated by the FDA, and they felt that there probably was not an association, that the original drug study was not powered high enough so that the number of patients that did have cardiac events while taking this drug really had it by true and unrelated association. Okay, we just did not have enough patients, and they were dealing with a population of patients that should have an increased incidence of cardiac events. So they had delayed marketing this drug by 3 years, and they took their patient population and made it powerful enough to show that there was no statistical significance. I think they had to go to either 18 or 20,000 patients to show that there was no relationship. But this business with uric acid being predictive in terms of coronary artery disease is disturbing, because one of the questions that will arise at some point in time is whether, well, I have this patient with a population of patients with uric acid levels of 7.5 or 8. Should we, the same way as we lower their cholesterol, should we be lowering their uric acid? I don't know. But anyway, it's an oral xanthine oxidase inhibitor. It's distinct from allopurinol. And everybody on this drug goes to under a level of 6. There are only 2 doses of the drug, 40 milligrams, 80 milligrams. And there's minimal adverse effects. And they did their homework when this drug was released. They chose a population of patients with renal insufficiency to prove safety. Safety was no worsening renal function and no increased incidence of adverse effects. So the drug turns out to be the drug that you would use, the judge would ask you to use. Listen, you have a patient with renal insufficiency. why in the world did you give them allopurinol? I gave them allopurinol because I wanted to protect them, and that would work up until now. They would then claim, ask you, why didn't you use this medication? Because there's clearly no worsening of renal disease, no increase of adverse events. So right now, this drug is a second-line drug. It's given to patients that have impaired glomerular filtration rates, and it's very, very, very effective. It's so effective that the first dosing of the medication has an incidence of acute attacks of the gout of about 7%. So even though you're prophylaxing, whenever you start allopurinol, the patient has to be on a background prophylaxis like colchicine. Despite colchicine, this drug has a very high incidence of triggering acute attacks because it so effectively lowers uricase levels. Pegylated uricase, just approved. This is a last resort drug. It's given intravenously. And you can actually see tophi decrease in size by 20 or 30% after 2 weeks or 4 weeks of this drug. Mind-boggling in terms of its effect. One of the issues is it's intravenous, and the other issue is that the intravenous drug has about a 10 to 15% incidence of anaphylactoid-like reactions. You familiar with the drug? Okay. There's fever, blood pressure problems, and all kinds of other things that happen with it. So the patients wind up being pre-medicated. You're taking a gout patient, and you're pre-medicating him with 300 milligrams of Cyacortef, which is nice. Everybody feels good after that, and they're given IV Benadryl and a whole lot of other things, and the infusions are once every 2 weeks. Stuff is very expensive, and this is the intravenous business, and the side effects are creating real problems in terms of rationalizing the use of this medication. This is probenecid, uricosuric agent. It enhances urine excretion of uric acid. No one used Benamid. If you put somebody on Benamid, the danger of using Benamid is that it really increases your uric acid level in your urine. So you really have to do something to keep the uric acid in solution. So that means alkalinizing the patient. So if you have a patient with hypertension or congestive heart failure and you choose baking soda, sodium bicarbonate, to keep their pH up, you may put them into pulmonary edema as you prophylax them. So I mean, you have to figure out how to make their urine alkaline without endangering them. And it effectively lowers uric acid. It's a pain in the neck to use. The patient has to commit to consuming at least a cup, you know, one or two quarts of water daily. The patients theoretically are supposed to check their urine pH, you know, two or three times a week to make sure that the urine is alkaline. So you picture compliance now, asking somebody to check their pee to see whether they're alkaline, and they have to be compliant in terms of the amount of fluid that they take in. It's a difficult trick. It's a good medication. It was our first line of drug. It increases kidney stones. It cannot be used with patients with renal disease. It can't be used in patients with history of stones. And there are some side effects with the medication. Contraindications, elevated urine, uric acid level. That's the reason for doing a 24-hour collection. Pre-existing renal disease, kidney stones. Okay, xanthine oxidase inhibitor, uricosuric agent. Okay, mild gout, and you want to lower uric acid, but I guess this using a uricosuric agent. But after that, allopurinol, and now it's going to be febuxostat or euloric. And frankly, I'm surprised that nobody has come here just to discuss the drug. It's outrageously expensive, so that may not be yet in the health and hospital system. As a matter of fact, it's so expensive that the drug company recognizes that a lot of the managed care do not want to pay for it. They'll actually foot the bill to get the patients onto it, because they know for sure it's going to be cleared soon. Anybody know about colchicine and its availability as a prescription drug? Huh? It's not tough to get. It's no longer available in New York State as colchicine generic. The only stuff you can get, colchicine was grandfathered. Colchicine has been available since Benjamin Franklin, but it's been available as a pill since 1905 and 1910. There were no standards in terms of manufacturing. There are no standards in terms of monitoring, etc. So there's only one company that went through all of the hoops that they had to go through for the FDA to say this is a legal product. So all colchicine that exists on the market now is generic, is illegal, and it's now no longer available. New York State was the next to last state to run out of colchicine. So the only stuff that you can get now is something called Colchris that costs, colchicine usually costs per month about $4 or $5. The prescription Colchris runs between $120 and $180 a month. So the colchicine, which is the standard of care, basic, as a prescription, you can't, none of the drug companies want to pay for it. Again, the manufacturers of Colchris are willing to pay to get the patients onto it. They're going to cover the copay and whatever, and they're willing to do that for the next year. What is the role of urate-lowering drugs like allopurinol or probenecid in treating acute gout? Any role? None. Zero. Okay. Rules of engagement. Don't mess with the uric acid level, period. Don't change the uric acid therapy during an acute attack. One of the mistakes that's made, let's say you get an attack of the gout and you know that the allopurinol triggered the attack. Don't stop the allopurinol. Just live through the attack, let the patient live through the attack and keep going. If you stop the allopurinol and then you have to restart it all over again 3 or 4 weeks down the line, the patient will go through hell and get more attacks. So you leave the allopurinol stand. Okay? All right. The case that was presented, this is the way his life should have been managed. Okay? Give him an NSAID or give him steroids. Okay? For the first 1 to 10 days. All right? Start the colchicine in low doses as prophylaxis. You're going to keep him on the colchicine at least for a year while you're adjusting his uric acid lowering agent. So I had a uric acid of 11 and change, so his uric acid has to be lowered. Start the allopurinol, and the allopurinol is started someplace around here, like 2 weeks into the attack is better, colchicine is continued, you can keep the colchicine going for a year and keep the allopurinol going after that. And NSAIDs, why in the world would you use NSAIDs in somebody with the gout? A lot of the patients wind up with chronic tophaceous disease, so they're sort of like an osteoarthritic patient. They have an awful lot of chronic joint pain related to deformities or problems related to the joint's anatomy. So in that situation, you're going to wind up putting the patient on NSAIDs. And that's it. Okay. Questions? No questions? Everybody knows what to do with the gout now?
Is there any choice to replace colchicine because it became more generic? So.
No, there's Colchris is the one company. There's another company that's going through the marketing of it. Colchris realizes that the American College of Rheumatology is very, very upset with the FDA. There's been a lobby from my organization saying this is crap. You have agents that have been manufactured by several companies with reasonable reliability, and to have this no longer as a legal drug and only have colchicine, one of the oldest drugs that we have, as a new prescription drug at an outrageous cost is not fair. There's just too many patients that need it. And so what are you doing for colchicine at Bronx Municipal Hospital? I mean, they're gonna have to, you know. There's gonna be litigation. Obviously, there. You can't. If you have somebody who's on colchicine and needs it prophylactically, you can take the colchicine away and allow the patient to become crippled, and now he can't go to work anymore. And it's gonna be an interesting thing. Anyway, I have cards in my office that the patient brings to the pharmacist. They pay $10 or $15 for the prescription, which is actually twice what they were paying for the colchicine, and they get their month's supply. And the patients grumble, despite this card, that why are they paying for this now and they never had to pay for it before. Anyway, unless you go into the fields, you can find some colchicine leaves and you can make some tea. And any other questions?
How long will you put someone on colchicine, the prophylaxis, before you start the allopurinol?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yeah. Let's say I'm meeting the patient for the first time. Dr. Smith referred the patient to me. His uric acid is this high. and I don't know what to do with him, and I get to see the patient because the patient has, you know, a couple of other little ticklers, like the patient does have renal insufficiency, and the patient is on diuretic therapy that's also aggravating this, and blah, blah, blah. So usually the colchicine is started. All right, so if you have somebody with a creatinine of over 2 and you want to prophylax them, the usual scheme is to give them 0.6 milligrams 3 times a week, probably no more than that. If somebody has normal kidney function and you really want to prophylax them adequately, it's usually 0.6 milligrams twice daily, and it's at least for 2 weeks. Having said that, even though you're prophylaxing them, if you start them on febuxostat, that drug is so damn potent in terms of dropping a uric acid, I guess that's good, but it's bad. There's a reasonable high probability, despite your prophylaxis, he's going to have another attack. Okay. Otherwise, you go with Bontis. That's what you got to do. All right, so where do...